Item nine. It's our review of our total portfolio performance for the period ending September 30, 2024. That would be Q3. Welcome. Good morning.
Good morning. So things changed quite a bit on November 5th, a bit of a watershed event in terms of market impact and the things that we know now and can expect going forward. And I'm going to comment on that a little bit, just make some brief and broad comments before turning it over to Danny, who's going to cover performance for you. So the materials that you have in your deck are up to September 30th, so a little bit stale at this point because things have changed a fair amount. And I want to touch on the themes of rates, inflation, and political impact or election impact. So rates, as you probably know and remember, back in mid-September, Powell and company lowered rates 50 basis points, the Fed funds rate target 50 basis points, which was a bit of a surprise to market participants. The betting was on 25 basis points. He came in a little hot at 50. And then again on November 7th, lowered them another 25 basis points. So the target Fed funds range has gone from a cyclical high of 525, low end of the range, 525 up to 550. Now it's 47 basis points lower than that. So rates are coming down. You may recall a year or so ago, people were betting on a lot more rate relief, and that has not come to pass. Rate declines have come sort of slower and steadier than the market was thinking a year ago. And now Chairman Powell is saying future rate cuts will come slowly and deliberately, in quotes. So the market is still betting on another 25 basis point cut at the December meeting. But the odds on that cut are really just above even, down from mid 80%. Betting on a cut prior to the election. Now it's like, okay, 50-50, we think we're going to get a cut in December, and future cuts will come slowly. Interestingly, while the Fed funds and short-term rates have come down, longer-term rates have gone up. And you've seen what I've talked about in the past was an inverted yield curve with short rates being higher than long rates. The curve has reverted and is back to sort of a normal, more normally shaped curve, which changed the condition of the inverted curve, which lasted for quite some time. The reason higher rates are going up while lower rates are coming down is concern over inflationary and stimulative pressures that are coming with the new administration's stated policies, right? So if you think about it, and you've probably heard all this in the financial press, tariffs are inflationary. Taxes, the extension of the 2017 tax program, you know, potentially stimulative and inflationary. Immigration policies, potentially inflationary. And deregulation, stimulative, potentially inflationary. So the market is looking ahead at some of these policies and how they're going to get implemented and to what extent they're going to get implemented and thinking, okay, you know, inflationary pressures, we're probably going to have pretty good economy, and we're going to have inflation and rates higher for longer, which actually is in line with some of the portfolio changes you guys made mid last year. The last comment I'll make is thinking about this Trump trade, right, based on expected policies, you're seeing sort of continued U.S. exceptionalism. U.S. stocks have been outperforming international stocks or non-U.S. stocks for quite some time and are anticipated to continue doing so. Small cap stocks have sort of come back strongly, benefiting from the potential policies that I just mentioned. And small cap stocks have not been in favor for quite some time, but they've come back strong. The U.S. dollar, strong U.S. dollar, and then long rates, all of those sort of moving up as part of response to the new administration's policies. And with that, I'm going to pause, see if there are any questions before I turn it over to Danny.
So the thought was they're going to continue to cut rates.
Slowly.
Well, now slowly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
but actually they might have to go up if inflation really hits, right? I mean, we're not going to have inflation and then cut rates, right?
That would be a reasonable response. Or just sort of maintaining a steady path for a longer period of time.
And so that impact on small caps could actually send small caps back down.
So those are two competing forces, right?
Yeah.
So rates going up is definitely not a good thing for stocks, but, you know, onshoring, tariffs is a mixed bag for U.S. companies, but some companies will definitely benefit from international prices being higher and then, you know, shifting to U.S. production, U.S. Consumption of U.S. production. So there's definitely competing forces with inflation and rates rising with some of the other impacts of those policies. But you're spot on.
Scott, considering how much rests on the chairman's decisions, is he fireable after January 20?
So he was asked that question.
Was he? Okay.
At the last response.
I think he said no.
He said no.
Is that the answer?
I think it is.
Okay.
Yeah, that's my understanding. I mean, the administration could put pressure on him, but at this point, he's an independent body and is appointed and not fireable.
Okay. For a term, and that term is yet to finish. Okay.
I'm sure the new attorney general will have an opinion on that, John, for you.
I was trying really hard not to let this slip into a political discussion.
Yeah.
I thought I did my part.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I won't do that again. Any other questions?
Jerry, did you have anything to add?
Yeah, I was thinking we could outsource this to Putin because apparently a fall from the fifth floor is always an option, apparently, in Russia. Happens a lot, apparently. Slip and falls.
So, Danny, you can see how this stage is lining up for you. The floor is yours.
I have a question.
Oh, Dennis, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Do you expect the current administration being very anti-ESG?
Not an obvious sort of economic impact, but certainly the trends towards ESG investing have slowed.
Is risk mitigation, and the more that we speak to fund managers, the more it seems to be embraced. This is a good thing if people are really looking at good governance and everything else associated with ESG, aside from a political statement of, you know, a feel-good kind of thing. But actually, it just seems to be more and more prevalent that good ESG practice is good risk mitigation practice.
I believe that that's true. The argument seems to be around, and language in statements to investors, right, seems to be around, what can you consider as part of your investment decision-making process? And so a lot of states have put into their charters, you cannot consider non-pecuniary or non-financial factors when making an investment decision, whereas the previous the outgoing administration has said, no, you can consider ESG factors in your decision-making process. Now, interestingly, you know, if you talk to investors, they've always considered governance as something that they've considered in their process, right? Good governance leads to good investor outcomes. More recently, they've started, as part of the ESG trend, started to consider the E and the S factors, and it's the E that has really been the point of contention between the competing ideologies. I agree with you. It seems like, to the extent that you're considering risk in the portfolio, each E, S, and G is things that I would want to consider as an investor through my modeling, through my qualitative and quantitative considerations when buying a stock. But that seems to be where the crux is. Like, what are the things that you can consider when making an investment decision. And if it doesn't have to do with financials and future returns and, you know, what you can expect in terms of company performance, one side is saying, no, those really are the only things that you can consider.
Well, with respect to environmental, I mean, let's say Dow Chemical spills, you know.
Right.
And then that's environmental impact that has liability
and
costs associated with
it. For sure.
So that's all. I still tie that as coming back to the financial impact and the bottom line of the company.
Right? I 100% agree with you.
Yeah. All right. I don't see any other hands up, so the floor is yours.
All right. So diving into the third quarter performance report here, I'm going to start off with the portfolio reconciliation. So beginning market value was $11.3 billion. Net cash inflow, $208 million. And that's largely employer contributions coming into the plan to pay benefit payments. Net investment change or appreciation of $486 million. So really strong performance for the third quarter. Ending market value was $11.99 billion. If you look over at year-to-date, you can see the appreciation there. The net investment change has been over $1 billion. So really strong performance quarter-to-date, really strong performance year-to-date, and even looking over the rolling 1 year, which we'll get into right now. So if we dive into the actual performance that we've seen recently, quarter-to-date, portfolio's up 4.3%. relative to the policy index at 4.4% and the implementation benchmark at 4.4%. So strong absolute performance, slightly lagging behind the policy index. The policy index and the implementation benchmark, just as a reminder here, those are aligned now in that they're the same. This goes back to the board resolution policy and it deviating from the strategic asset allocation policy. So the last year or so, those are the same. If you go back further in time, though, there were differences, and we reflect that here in the report. Over the quarter, growth is really the assets that's been the strongest in the portfolio. It's over 70% of the portfolio, up 4.8% versus the custom benchmark at 4.4%. If you look year-to-date and 1 year, performance on an absolute and relative basis have been really strong. Diversifying assets haven't quite met the benchmark there, up 2.1%, so positive absolute performance, but lagging behind the benchmark at 4.6%. And then last is liquidity. Liquidity has been surprisingly good. Well, maybe not surprisingly, but it's been it's there. Your liquidity bucket's there to pay benefit payments and provide liquidity to the portfolio. But if you look out to the one-year number, this portfolio has been up 8%, right? So really strong returns in a bucket that's intended to be capital preservation and liquidity. So really good, good there. And we'll slide down to diving into our net of fee performance. If I can find it there. All right, so starting off, I had alluded that the growth bucket was really strong. Basically, every manager and every asset class within the growth bucket was positive from an absolute perspective, with one exception, and I'll get into that in a second. Within domestic equity, the passive BlackRock Russell 1000 Index, if you look at that over the one-year period, it was up 35.7%. It matches the benchmark. It's a passive strategy. It's what we expect, but really strong performance from large-cap domestic equity. If we look at one of our active managers, Boston Partners, this is a concentrated strategy. They hold about 80 stocks. They underperformed this quarter. They were up 6%, but the Russell 1000 Value Index was up 9.4%. Underperformance was due to the positioning that they had in energy and information technology. So their philosophy, their kind of long-term thinking of why they put stocks in this portfolio is they have this Venn diagram where they're looking for attractive valuations, strong business fundamentals, and positive business momentum. And if you look longer term, this has worked out great for them, right? So there's no change in our confidence in this strategy. They underperformed this quarter, but longer term, they've been great. International equity up 7.2% versus the benchmark of 8.2%. There's two benchmarks here. There's the All Country World ex-US and the EAFE Index. EFA index was up 7.3, so a little bit less underperformance there. Within emerging market equities, portfolio was up 5.3, underperforming the benchmark, though, at 8.7. One of the managers we had talked about earlier this year was the TT Emerging Market Strategy. We had put them on provisional watch due to a departure of a portfolio manager. So we're watching this closely. They did really well earlier in the year and have given back a little bit of it, but no change recommended at this point. Nothing there. We're just reporting on that manager and saying, you know, we're paying attention to that. Moving on to the
on that point, what is there a general time frame, a feeling about what's an appropriate period of time to look at a manager whose performance may be checkered, right? Up, down, up. What's the time horizon? This question comes up a lot at conferences and, in terms of talking amongst various systems, and I'd like to get your view on that.
Sure.
Yeah, I'll jump in there. So, that question does come up a lot, and it's probably the most asked and hardest to answer question that I've gotten in my 22 years of doing this, right? And the answer is not a very satisfying one. It depends, and it's not a time-specific thing because every situation is different. And so we look at, instead of time-based and quantitative factors, we look at more at qualitative factors, which is why we put them on provisional watch, because a decision maker left that was sort of important to the investment process. And so that gives us pause, and now we watch that to see if, for example, is anybody else going to leave? Are there different organizational changes? Do they start losing assets, which might make them unable to have the resources to invest in the company and the team in the future? And so it's those qualitative things that we're really paying attention to. Now, we definitely do pay attention to performance as well, but it's performance that would not meet expectations, right? Like, are they doing poorly when we would expect them to do well relative to their strategy and what those expectations are? Or are they doing really well when we would expect them to do poorly relative to, you know, how they're supposed to do with their strategy? So it's not time based.
Have a benchmark, though. I mean, it's not in the abstract, right? We're yes. Looking at their performance against a benchmark.
Yes, 100%. 100%.
Okay. So that's quantitative, right? That's yes. It's a real measuring
yes.
stick, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thanks for that clarification. But it's not time based. Now, there comes a time when you just are like, you know, even though I can't get any true indication whether we should terminate them or not for what I'm calling qualitative reasons, 5 years have gone by and they're still underperforming and we don't really have a good feel of it, but we just got to cut them loose, right? So, you know, if you hold my feet to the fire and say, what's the time frame, I would say 5 years. But it's a really difficult question to answer.
Yeah, and my reaction would be, that's a really long time. Just, you know, just giving you my feedback.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate right? that. And my response to that is there have been studies, and we have done studies internally mimicking the broader studies that have been done that show managers that outperform over very long periods of time have pretty long periods of time of underperformance, right? But the outperformance and underperformance is cyclical. And so you can have a manager that underperforms over 5 years, but will outperform over 10. So it's sort of counterintuitive, but it's what the data shows.
That's a toughie, to
be
sure.
It is.
For sure. Has the team at TT convinced you to have faith?
I mean, like, okay, they've lost. Let's just head managers, but okay, we're sticking to our plan, and nothing's going to change. And going forward, we have these people in the pipeline. We're going to join the team,
That's what our research team is today. So faith is a strong word. We believe that they will continue with the performance that you'd expect and that they've gotten in the past over time.
Or better performance since they haven't been doing so great.
Yeah. Well, as Danny said, they did well after the departure, and then they're just having a bad quarter now. So.
Okay. Yeah, they started off the year strong, outperforming their benchmark, and then this quarter is this, you know, it changed. They're still doing pretty well if you look year to date and over the 1 year period, but something we're monitoring.
And just for additional context, the lead portfolio manager started to step away for personal reasons in 2023 with the intention of coming back. The lead portfolio manager is making all the top-down macroeconomic calls, so overweight this sector, underweight this sector, or this region. There wasn't somebody kind of full-time in that leadership role at the organization. He ultimately retired from the firm technically in the first quarter of this year, but functionally more fourth quarter of last year. We've met with the team several times, are confident that they are making the top-down macro calls they need to. They're making them in a more timely manner than they had been for the past couple of years. And I think being less beholden to the MSCI Emerging Markets benchmark, which is heavily dominated by China, and sometimes it's hard for managers to take deviations away from that big, huge position. The new leadership, which is a subset of the old leadership minus the lead portfolio manager, I think has taken a more active view of underweighting and overweighting major regions around the world. So we've seen a positive trend line in the first 6 months of the year, a little stumble here in the third quarter, and we just met with them a couple weeks ago and continue to have confidence in them. But they're not out of, to be clear, they are not out of the woods yet, but we're seeing a positive trend line.
Is the term provisional watch...
That's our term.
That's a Verisk term. That's not our term.
No.
Necessarily? Okay. All right, go ahead.
Come on. Okay. And then moving on to the next slide here. So within global equity was up 6.9, outperforming its benchmark, the MSCI All Country World Index, at 6.6%. One of the managers there within the global equity bucket that did quite well over the quarter was First Eagle. So First Eagle was up 9.8% versus its benchmark of 9.4%. First Eagle's an interesting manager. Their outperformance over the quarter is largely explained by their gold positioning. So it's a global equity manager, but they're holding gold. They see that as really a unique diversifier in their portfolio, but... the outperformance that quarter was really due to that Spider Gold ETF that they're holding in the portfolio.
I think they just had a bad week recently. Maybe two. Yeah, we'll see how they come out on the next quarterly look back.
Well, the good thing is private credit continues to do great things for the portfolio. It was up 3.1% over the quarter. If you look, over the 1 year, 3 year, 5 year. This has really been a very strong asset class in the portfolio and a really good program, contributing strong returns overall. We look within the high yield bucket. We can see here that performance was 3.8% versus the benchmark of 5.3. So looking into Voya Global Investors, the underperformance there was really related to credit quality. So... Voya has minimal exposure to CCC bonds, which is just one notch above default, right? So they're the lowest quality bonds you can hold, and Voya has minimal exposure to that. And those CCC bonds really outperformed double B and single B. So that's the reason why they underperformed their benchmark, is that they were holding higher quality, high yield bonds in the portfolio.
I wanted to take you back to private credit for just a quick question. It came up at a conference recently that there is potentially regulatory or legislative risk in terms of constraints that might be placed on private credit, sort of akin to banking, if you will. Nothing specific was really said, but have you heard anything similar to that there might be that type of risk?
I have not heard that. So that's news to me. I'll reach back out to our private credit team and see if they have heard anything.
And I think if I'm remembering right, I heard this after November 5, so I don't know that it was related necessarily to the political shift.
You can wipe that off of your thing.
I mean, if it was related to that, yeah, you might draw conclusions from that event. But my recollection was it was stated taking into account that change having been made. So.
There has always been, you know, sort of just little bubbles of concern about regulatory risk across private markets, not just private credit. I've not heard anything specific to private credit recently, but I'll ask.
Okay. Thanks.
So next up, real estate. So if we look at our total real estate composite here, up 1.6% versus the real estate benchmark of it was flat, and so we're actually seeing positive returns here in our real estate composite. There's two different stories underneath that, though. There's the story of our private real estate, which was down 3.6% over the quarter. So we're not out of the woods yet on this asset class. We continue to see write-downs in the space. But if you're looking for some silver lining and we look at the REITs, these could potentially be a leading indicator of where we may be going with the private assets, because these are much more frequently traded and valued. So if we look at our REIT exposure there, both managers were up more than 15% in the third quarter. So really strong performance from the REIT managers. And then the last thing I'll hit on here is just risk parity. Yeah. Oh, yeah, sorry.
I mean, the reason why it's down.
That was part of it, yeah. So, I mean, I think...
Let Tim jump in. I mean, we certainly have a large office exposure to our pre-COVID portfolio. I think it was roughly 25% of the private real estate going into COVID. Post-COVID, we have been extremely light on office. So you would see a combination of legacy write-downs in this negative number here, as well as just the higher rate environment has been depressing all valuations. That should, all things equal, start to reverse itself here in the fourth quarter, but we'll see what the marks come in at. But I think, you know, we still have seen legacy office and some multifamily get marked down recently. The industrials have been doing really well. I think that's kind of gone, more steady state at this point. Hotels came back during COVID, but have not been in strong demand. So you've got a lot of underlying forces there. So you are right, the office is the most troubled, but the rate environment affects all property types equally.
And so our relative decrease in exposure associated with value is not that we dumped all that property or sold it with secondaries or whatever, but that the actual value of the property has gone down, so it's less of a part of our overall portfolio, right?
Yeah, and I'm going to touch on this in my comments later on, but just the general theme of very little exit activity across all private markets, with right. The exception of private credit, which self-liquidates because it's a loan and it's going to self-liquidate over a couple of years. This is largely valuation-driven at this point. We have seen a couple of sales on the real estate side. There are anecdotes, there are tail-end funds. It's not really moving the needle a whole lot, but it's been quiet across the board.
Okay. And then just real quick, I'll hit on risk parity. So, you know, the board decided to eliminate risk parity from the strategic asset allocation. It's still in the portfolio as of 9:30, but it's being redeemed. And we spoke with Tim earlier this week. And as of today, other than a 5% holdback at Panagora, this portfolio has been fully redeemed. So kind of the conclusion here is, you know, we've seen really strong performance in the growth portfolio. Liquidity pool has been extremely strong too, providing, you know, 8% over the last year. The diversifying portfolio, some of it has kind of worked to expectations, and I think some of it has been underperforming. But overall, really strong performance for the quarter and really strong performance year to date and over the 1 year period. So I'll stop there and see if there's any additional questions.
Always good to end on, you know, a positive note, right? Finish up strong. Any questions or comments for Danny? Or Scott, for that matter? Not seeing any. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mr. Price?
Okay. I think rather than go through the CIO report panel by panel, I'm going to give you a higher level overview. This is probably the last time you're going to see the CIO report in this format. We started the process of working with the investment committee to come up with CIO report 2.0. Hopefully that'll be ready for the February meeting when we talk about year-end performance. But I think the takeaways here really, just to echo Danny and Scott's comments, liquidity working as expected, diversifying a turnaround in progress. We made a change earlier this year to eliminate Acadian and fund BHDG. We know there's more work to be done in that portfolio, but moving that one in the right direction. Growth really comes down to, this has been a public market dominated risk environment over the last 3 years here. Really since COVID and even going into COVID, you've just seen a lot of dormancy on the private market side. So with private equity, they had very low rates. They had a tremendous amount of activity in 2021. I think our private equity portfolio is up 60% that 1 year, and we've gone relatively flat since then. It remains relatively flat at this point. Stepstone is going to be here on December 11th to talk about the private equity environment, the acquisition environment, the disposition environment. I think that's going to be a great opportunity to get their views on what looks like going forward. I know in speaking with Brian, he's been at a lot of private equity annual meetings lately. The anecdotal chatter is that the lower rate environment and perhaps your return of animal spirits to the stock market is increasing hopefulness about the exit environment next year, but we really haven't seen this come through in a sea change. There's been a little bit more activity. The exits have roughly matched the contributions to new funds, so it's, you know, we're kind of staying in steady state there. What's been interesting is that you've seen the public equity markets up 30%+. Private equity firms have been holding valuations relatively constant. I know that coming into year end, they're going to have a little battle with their auditors about where marks should be. But when public markets are up that much, you would normally expect that, you know, private equity has usually about a 0.6 beta to the public market. So you expect roughly 60% of that on average to flow through. To date, we have not seen those marks move at all, but we also haven't seen dispositions move. And I think that's probably largely driving the behavior of private equity firms saying, if I'm not selling anything, I don't have good clean marks on my private positions, let me hold them at their cost basis. Within private credit, where we're typically making a loan, getting paid back over 3 to 4 years, you know, that one, the cash flow is built in, and we've seen that nice steady cash flow running right about 9 to 11%, and that's been a good anchor to the portfolio. And then real estate, which Danny just touched on, still challenged. I mean, what we're hearing from managers is this may be the bottoming of the valuation cycle here in 2024 and moving forward into 25. We'll get some more normalized activity, but we've talked about this at past meetings. The very few office transactions that have happened at distressed prices. So the only marks in the market are distressed marks. Your performing assets are not being sold. Performing assets are being held by the managers or by strategic owners, and they're clipping the coupon and enjoying that nice cash flow. It's only when you have a dead office building, a dead or dying office building, and the equity sponsor is wiped out and it goes back to the bank, and now the banks don't want to take it back because if the banks take it back, REO, real estate owned, gets repriced by a third party. If it's a loan, it doesn't get repriced. So there's a tension between some of these equity sponsors and the real estate lenders on some of these deals where there's really a lot of trouble. That's the messiest end of the market. The healthy and performing end of the market is just not transacting. We have made commitments over the past 2 years to alternative sectors primarily, so moving into industrial outdoor storage, into single family for rent, multifamily for rent, some of the things that are kind of outside that historical, you know, four food groups of real estate of office, multifamily, hospitality, and retail. And so I think we've tried to diversify this into the new sectors. That deviation between the public REIT market and the private real estate market is as wide as I've seen in my career. We have One market down 20% over the past year, one market up 35%. That gap has to close. Now, if you, you know, pin me down and say which direction is it, you know, is private markets going to trade up or public markets going to trade down? I'm probably going to say it's a little bit of both. I think there's a little bit of euphoria in the public markets. They've been drug up by the mega cap tech stocks. And just the rising trend of all public equities trading up. But the within the private real estate, when we start to see transactions happen and we start to see real valuations, which we're hopeful will be a 2025 event, that's when I'll be able to come back to the board and say, are we seeing a positive, neutral, or negative trend line from these current valuations? And that'll give us a lot more clarity. We simply don't have it right now. Yeah. Yeah, so it's interesting if you look at this, because stocks and real estate are traditionally considered inflationary hedges over a long enough time period here, that companies can pass through inflationary pressure onto the end customer, and that should benefit overall earnings growth and result in a higher stock price over time. In the short term, you get hit. In the long term, you can pass through. The same is typically true of a imbalance real estate market. So if you have an imbalanced real estate market and you have inflationary pressures, that's typically passed through in the form of higher rent over a rent increase cycle. And rents are, you know, hotels are one night and office buildings are 10-year leases. And so, you know, it kind of filters through there. The issue we have today is the real estate market is not in balance. We have an oversupply of office. We have an undersupply of housing. And the other ones looks like a roughly imbalance, but we have, you know, this new huge pent-up demand for data centers. How durable that is to be determined. We have a still an ongoing net positive demand for industrial space, but there's been a lot of build out in that realm. And now we're starting to see it's interesting. Just a quick aside on the industrial side, the value of your property depends on the power supply to your property. So if you don't have a high power capacity into that property, you can't do as much with it, and you certainly can't reposition it to light industrial or data centers. And, you know, if you go to PG&E and you want to put, you know, a huge power supply into a new building in Silicon Valley, you're talking several years at this point in time. So I think because you have some bifurcations in the in this real estate marketplace, that if we do have inflationary pressure, first of all, it kind of depends on how we have it. If it's supply shock, that's one thing. If it's just generally, you know, changes to our economy, it's a different thing. How the Fed responds and what that pass-through effect looks like. If the real estate market is imbalanced or undersupplied, they're going to be able to pass through. If they're oversupplied, they're going to have a lot of trouble passing through those inflationary pressures. But, I think we are probably third or fourth inning of office repositioning in this country, without a lot of clarity about what the end point is. I think we, in talking with our real estate managers, there's been a lot of reticence to tear down legacy office buildings. They think that's probably where they're going to get to. But that is a multi-year process as well. This looks like, whereas in the GFC, we had a quick shock. We were able to inject capital, and this plan did a lot of that injection of capital to rescue buildings, reposition them. There are office workers already there, and you could kind of be off to the races again. This feels like a slow-moving evolution that we don't have a lot of clarity on, so we're simply saying we are locked into our legacy office exposure. We are not making prospective office commitments unless it is something incredibly unique. But that's kind of the thought process there. So that those inflationary waves are going to filter through, but not equally. And not all at once. So with that, just another aside, this is as of 9:30. We continue to rebalance to the new posture that the board approved in August. The last of that rebalancing is happening as we speak. We had a couple of funds that had to change share classes and a couple of lockup periods that we had to move through. I'll report out on December 11th on that rebalancing. We continue to move forward our research on the new asset classes the board approved of multi-asset credit, treasury exposure, real estate credit. Again, the expectation that rates are going to be higher for longer, and we can get a rate of return very close to our actuarial discount rate in the debt market versus the equity market. We think that's still advantageous. That work will continue over the next 6 to 9 months, and hopefully have some positive news to bring back to the board here at the end, year end.
Can't wait. Sounds exciting. Any other questions for Tim on his report? Seeing none, thank you. All right, we'll talk on the 11th, I guess, again, right? We'll be back.